So as you answer these questions, as you think about these questions, if at the end of answering the question, if at the end of the discussion back and forth in the class, you don't feel that that was actually a substantive, complete, and satisfying answer, raise your hand and say so, and or be willing to say so in some way, and say why it isn't. And we will do our best to address it here, you know, kind of at the end of the question session. However, keep in mind that sometimes, oftentimes, especially for me, it's difficult to hear the right answer and instantly absorb it. It's the whole, let me go back and think about it thing, or maybe something you don't realize happens all the time is you disagree with somebody, and then 2 weeks later you come back and you've actually picked up their opinion. I do this all the time. And I'm like, yeah, I think this is the way that works. And the guy's like, yeah, I know, I told you that 2 weeks ago. I'm like, oh, this was your idea, was it? I did that to one of my engineers at work. I was like, hey, remember how I told you, I came up with it? I thought about it. You were the guy that actually told me that. He was like, yeah, no, I know. Yeah, not the first time that's happened. There's a term for that called cryptamnesia, which is people who steal other people's ideas without even knowing they're doing it. All right, so be willing to answer it for yourself. And the other one is how, put it in a format, be able to articulate your response to somebody so that is hostile to your viewpoint. That is hostile to your viewpoint. It's not enough to put the truth out there. If you want to be convincing and you have the right truth and you're talking to somebody that has a different opinion than you do, you have to be willing to stand in their shoes and say, what questions are they asking? How are they looking at it? And then how am I going about answering their questions? So you can't just answer your own concerns and questions. You have to look at their legitimate concerns and questions, and maybe their illegitimate concerns and questions. So sometimes if you can detect if they've got a mental block that isn't actually immediately germane to the subject matter, addressing that mental block occasionally can be offensive if you're not careful about it, but ultimately may be something that's necessary in order to help communicate the totality of your idea. All right, enough on my part. Here's my first question to you. You Christians talk an awful lot about your doctrine, about who Jesus is, about why I need him, about why you think you've got the right answer. But at the end of the day, it is an open question as to whether God exists at all. How are you so confident, and we saw a version of this in email recently, you're so confident that you've got the right answer, and you can't even tell me, you can't even prove that God exists in the same way that I can prove anything in science and anything in math. If God is so real, why is he so hard to find? So that's your first one, and now it's all on you. So this can be discussion back and forth. It would be ideal, but fire away. How would you answer that question? I'll take a sip break. That didn't take long. Okay, do it.
Throw myself out there. Just how complex this world is, and to think that it just willed itself into existence or just accidentally happened seems to me to be a bit just not as probable as having a cause and thus a causer. That's where I would start.
Okay.
So what you're sitting on is the cosmological argument, okay? So.
Okay, and can you outline that for us?
Man, it's been a while. But it's a... Oh, my goodness. Three statements, thank you.
What is it? Everything that begins to exist has to first. Anything that begins to exist has a cause. Is that premise one? The universe began to exist, premise two, premise three. The universe had a beginning. So the universe had a cause.
Okay.
Another word fits in that there's also the concept of having a self mover.
A prime mover idea, yep, okay.
Like, if everything is caused by effect, then what's the initial cause? Something has to be able to cause itself to move or to cause other causes.
Okay. Anybody have any comments on that, either for or against?
I think that the criticism that modern scientists would bring up, the Larry Krauss's of the world, would be, well, sure, but you know, right now it looks like the most likely cause is quantum fluctuation.
Okay.
Because we have no empirical evidence of God's existence. You know, if Larry Krauss's argument would be, if your argument for God's existence is the existence of the world, well, again, we have a better scientific theory. And it may not be fully fleshed out right now, but the evidence is leading us toward, suggests that this quantum fluctuation is probably our best bet right now.
Okay, so...
Yeah.
So the idea that these guys have is there was essentially, when the universe was almost at a infinitely dense point, but maybe not quite infinitely dense, there were just a few tiny particles, quarks or something like that, that were just fluctuating, and all of a sudden, boom, the Big Bang came out of that.
But isn't that still what made the particle? Isn't that the whole argument?
Their follow-on to that, this quantum fluctuation could have been going on for millions or billions of years, or possibly, I think they would maybe even argue an eternity.
Infinitely.
Right.
So, okay. But it does not explain how the quarks got there.
Yeah.
So a quick minor scientific correction there. The quarks don't come into existence for a while.
So this is
fluctuations in some kind of quantum field like this. So here's our quantum field, and what we see is these kind of little fluctuations that are occurring, and all this is really an energy level in this field, and that these fluctuations that are non-regular, when they expand out, that is what, when we're seeing the cosmic microwave background out there, it's those little fluctuations that got expanded into different densities that then cause the matter to collapse in on itself, and thus you get this type of thing. So, but with that, Carl's exactly right. So keep going along the lines you were going.
I mean, I think that's their retort, which, again, I think it's susceptible to the criticism that was just brought up. Well, how did that quantum field come into existence?
Right.
And if it really existed forever in the past, then you've got the problem, that Hawking jokes about in the beginning of Brief History of Time, when the woman says, "Well, all this theory is all great, but really we know that the Earth is just supported by a turtle." And he said, "Well, what supports the turtle?" "Well, I know, you're being tricky to me. Well, it's turtles all the way down."
Very clever young fellow, but it's turtles all the way down. Right.
This infinite regress problem. But from a philosophical perspective, I think that the scientists really do have a problem there, because what changes, if there was an infinite amount of time prior to the Big Bang event, then... this event, this Big Bang event, should have happened some earlier time. So I don't think their theory holds up, but that's the theory that a lot of scientists feel great confidence in voicing that theory, and don't feel that our criticism of it is legitimate. So, again...
Now, I think the reason is because, just from the very start of the question, if you come at it from a scientific perspective, methodological naturalism, we have all this evidence for the world around us and how these phenomena occur, and I say, prove God, and you immediately go shift to philosophy and metaphysics. You have basically said, you have conceded all of the natural scientific world, and said, I'm not going to provide any evidence, in the natural scientific world, we have to move into a different domain and discipline to have this argument. I think you have to do that right from the start. I think you have to, if you're going to have the argument, you have to say, well, this, you know, you are a scientist, and you operate, and science operates under the rules of methodological naturalism, and that will not explain supernatural phenomena by definition. So we have to have a philosophical discussion. And they have to be okay with that. Because if they're not, you're never going to meet.
But isn't the whole methodological argument that you can observe something and say that there is a cause to something that comes? So you're using the system, but you're just not able to point to empirical, identifiable evidence. You're just using the same system of thought they use.
Right.
The entire premise
is that every effect has a cause. Yeah. And that the cause can be seen, and that the cause can be seen in the natural world, can be observed and experimented and reproduced.
Yeah.
Which is the basis of science.
Yeah.
So the idea is you start to get a little hazy on the experimental and reproduction part of saying, well, you know, if God created the world, he should be creating other worlds that we're able to observe. Like, and that may be, that's, I think, a stretch.
I didn't follow that last part, Scott.
So he was saying that, you know, the argument, the philosophical argument, I think, is that there is a cause to everything in the universe, and science should be able to walk us back all the way to the beginning. But there is a point, I think there is a point at the start where you get up to that boundary, and there's always something prior to that, and there's a point where we reach the ends of observational science and the ends of our information that we have right now, arguably what we can even possibly know. There will always be something before that shifts into philosophical or theological.
Well, I think to that point right there, I think that that's actually one of the biggest criticisms that we have to offer of the modern scientific method that almost everyone has bought hook, line, and sinker, is we can do this reverse extrapolation of data and say,
right,
we know that the universe is X billions years old.
Right.
Right? And I think that's not the same as a scientific experiment when I take iron and water and heat them up and I get a new compound, right? Because we can reproduce that experiment over and over and over again. That's true science. The reverse extrapolation stuff that we're doing is not the same kind of science because
it's philosophy.
It is philosophy, right? We're taking some factual data, right? We can say, here's what I've observed in the universe, but we're now saying, I'm going to, based off the data that I observed today, I'm going to say what happened a billion, 2 billion, 4 billion years ago. To me, those are radically different categories of thought process, of knowledge development. But we have, basically all society, Christians too, have bought into the idea, and it's funny because Pastor Mike actually kind of brought this up, I think it was last week in a sermon, you know, the idea that we can do this reverse extrapolation isn't the same as science. And I think we have to be more skeptical than we are. I'm not saying we should abandon all of that, but we should realize the limitations of the reverse extrapolation, that scientists want to engage it, and they want to put it on par with the traditional scientific method that says repeatability, verifiability can be done. That's how we develop theories.
Doesn't science do that in some cases? Like the stuff we're doing where we kind of make it a theoretical situation. Aren't they doing that in their own science in some ways? Like when we talk about certain theories they've come up with, it's because they don't have all of the evidence they need. I'm kind of pointing, I guess, to evolutionary theory.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
because they don't have all of the data there to say, yes, this is exactly true.
Right.
You know, so they're essentially taking what we're doing and trying to make it true. And I think that's the reverse argument back to them. It's like, all right, if you want to just talk about everything observable, then we don't really have a discussion to have, right? Right? We can't point back to the beginning of time because no one was there, you know. At least we don't think so.
So, I guess... Sorry, Joe. So I would do from the other side is this one, I would say, for your quantum fluctuations, you would, I'm trying to remember how exactly you phrased it, but essentially the scientists would contend that how do we know this hasn't happened before? Essentially, if quantum theory is correct, my understanding is that the universe will eventually collapse back on itself and then re-expand. So actually, this big theory conversation, if the world is entirely deterministic, has happened an infinite times in the past and will continue an infinite times in the future.
No, but I think
the second thing I would probably go to there is say, okay, let's, maybe I'm speculating at that point. Great, I agree with that. But what using Occam's razor, is the better, the simpler, the explanation, or the explanation that posits the fewer number of entities? A few, I don't know the theory exactly, but it sounds like a few quantum particles moving around. It's a lot simpler than an all-powerful, all-loving God who sent his son, like, somehow born of a virgin to come onto the earth and then, like, live a perfect life and then die, and then, like, somehow we're all...
Yeah, but that's not the whole story of God.
Right. Okay, but my point is that the first explanation seems a whole lot simpler. So while it may not be correct, it seems that I'm more rational to believe that or to go on that than the, you know, the theistic.
So I guess in response to the first part, you know, with the universe that's collapsing and re-expanding, etc., I think all modern scientists that I'm aware of reject that basically because it would be a violation of the second law of thermodynamics, that there's always increasing entropy. There doesn't seem to be a reorganizing force in the universe, at least according to methodological naturalism. And I think that's, I don't think Larry Krauss or anybody...
Hawking will give an explanation of that. I don't quite understand it, but he will give it.
An explanation of what?
For how you can maintain the second law of thermodynamics in a re-collapsing universe. Essentially, he argues that entropy is still, like, actually, like, the universe is actually still getting disordered even as it's collapsing. I don't know exactly how he does it, but there are some people who will give up time.
Yeah, I don't think it's a mainstream view, at least within
physics. And so I don't know.
And I think the Occam's razor, I think, is interesting because I think, again, that's it's so widely accepted. Everybody says, let's use Occam's razor. Why should we use Occam's razor?
Well, it seems
it's a rule of convenience is all it is.
So when you're using Occam's razor, you're not saying that the simpler explanation is always true. But given the choice of two possible or multiple possible explanations, you know, the reason we are all here today is likely because, you know, we all decided on our own to come here. Not because a host of angry leprechauns kidnapped us all and put us into this room. It's a possible explanation, but again, we tend to go with the one that's simplest and makes the most sense.
But I think Occam's razor is really brought in when you have two competing theories that are otherwise both equally reasonable to believe. Right? So, Occam's razor, we don't exclude the leprechaun theory for how we got here based on Occam's razor. We do it because there's no evidence for that.
Well, I would say it's a form of it, essentially. Occam's razor, purely stated, is the explanation that involves the fewest number of entities is the one thing.
Occam's razor is going to bring you to the two. To the two choices. That's what Occam's razor is going to do.
So that guy's got a question.
It's not going to define those two. It's going to bring you to
Occam's razor will prefer the one that does not needlessly multiply entities beyond necessity.
So I'm going to take all this and put it in more simpler ideas. There's two forms of analyses that have come out in the past 30 years or so in terms of kind of honing in on a set of vocabulary regarding systems, which everything is. So there's two types of systems that people have, you know, built out and said, okay, this is a general form, this is a general form. And it goes into the category of complicated systems and complex systems. Complicated system is a system that has n number of moving parts, all of which you can tell between, you know, from this point to that point exactly what's going to operate or how it's going to operate. Complex system is a system that has n number of interactions, so where those interactions are incredibly sensitive to initial conditions. So systems end up being analyzed based on sensitivity to initial conditions, of which you can't possibly know ever how the system initially began as a result of that sensitivity. So when you're talking about interpolation, essentially, That's a huge problem in science, is you can't go back that way because the system itself was so sensitive to initial conditions that there's no way to tell at any end point, any end instance before that, where we were. So, you know, you're right in your intuition to think about that, but that's the end. analytical way, that's the way you would argue to a scientist that they don't know what they're really thinking they know as a result of that, because they haven't properly analyzed the sensitivity of the system.
There's an interesting point, by the way, that is my own. I'm very interested in this one because I think that approach explains why we have overreached on quantum mechanics, and you see a lot of the guys going back to quantum field theory. In fact, I heard Sean Carroll recently, I don't know if he did it recently, but he put something out that basically says quantum field theory is the way to go after stuff, not quantum mechanics, which seems intuitively true to me, but an interesting point. Sorry, back to the discussion.
So I want to ask, is what you're saying is that we talk about we refer to everything and talk about everything like it's complicated systems that can be understood?
That's right.
And really, they're all complex. There's many of them that are complex systems that we do not have, nor can we obtain the information to actually know.
That's right.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So we tend to assume that systems are complicated when they're actually complex.
Okay.
Yes.
And how do you know it's not vice versa?
It's simply a
No, I mean, can you help me understand what you're
saying? So it sounds like you're saying that our base assumption is that systems are complicated when oftentimes they are actually complex in terms of their interactions and almost inability to be explained or understood entirely without understanding the sensitivity of the underlying assumptions. I think what the non-theist will argue, or I think we need to go to theism, we can just say that how do we know that there aren't complex systems, or that the systems that we may possibly be complex are really just complicated if we knew all the underlying assumptions we could actually understand the system.
Sorry, that's a good point. So, yeah, so the whole argument to that isn't that I'm throwing out or rejecting the idea that the system really is fundamentally complicated, but the idea is that the scientist who's interpolating doesn't really have the right to interpolate as a result of the fact that the system is complex, meaning so that the number of interactions within that system are such that you don't have the right to interpolate because you can't.
You can't see it. You don't know it. It's still unknown. Complicated is something there's too many unknowns, whereas in complex, you know them all.
Other way, yeah. Exact right idea, but just the other two. Yeah.
So this seems to go back to like our understanding of empiricism, and I think that's something that is fuzzy for me.
If anybody's wondering what the heck's going on right now, what we've actually watched before Steve makes his point is we asked a question about God. This is a fundamental question that everybody wants to know the answer to. And the first thing we did, what was the first thing that we actually started talking about? We asked somebody made a philosophical point about, Steve made the philosophical point about, we need an explanation. And then that immediately took us into a discussion, as Skylar said, of science, it was a discussion of spelling, a discussion of science, and said, what is the purview of and what are the limits of science? And then where do we go from there? We talked about some limits to science, about whether there are edges to explanations, and how successful science has been in predicting those things, and whether models of a cyclical universe or whatever have even appeared. And then we immediately got into epistemology. I don't know how to spell. That might not be right. Epistemology. So we're back to a set of philosophical questions. Just note what's happening here, which is a good one, which is this class is not afraid to differentiate between science and the philosophy that underlies science. But don't lose sight of the question. So are the things that we're asking right now, are the things we're talking about, necessary to talk about in order to answer the question, why are you, believer, so confident that God exists? So whilst this is a good discussion, and we can continue to have it and should continue to have it, for the for the purposes of answering this question, let's pretend that the guy or gal you're talking to is sitting across the table from you at Starbucks, and their eyes are starting to blur a little bit. All right? So take us back to this question. All this is good and proper to talk about, and in my opinion, if you don't talk about it and you don't delve into it even more deeply than we have here, the good, solid, rational thinker will have skimmed over things about which they should have thought. So these are all good things. I'm not belittling them. You know how much I love talking about them. But take it back, not superficially, but core, back to how this is great. Why do you believe that God exists, and how is that convincing? Supposed to be convincing to me?
Another approach I would take is kind of talk about my own virtual experiences.
Okay, in a way that's going to be convincing. So that may be why you do. So why do your personal experiences, where are we? That's two. Okay, go ahead.
Just going through, basically, it'd be more of a intimate kind of, you know, this is my life, this is where I've seen things that have gone through in my life, and this is, you know, it's, there's things that have happened that I cannot give an explanation to.
Does anybody want to take this one up?
You know, where I go personally is that as I read the Bible, and this, you know, I'm not getting to the reliability of the Bible, but just reading the Bible for its own content, it's the only text that seems to speak to the truth of the human condition.
You have emphasis on truth.
I mean, that there's no other book that I know that talks about God that displays human beings, you know, the supposed heroes of the Bible, as such fundamentally flawed people. And that for me, corresponds directly to my experience in this world. That all people are flawed, even the people that we, you know, hold up the highest, whether it's General Petraeus or name whoever you want to name, every person is flawed. And the Bible seems to be the one book that doesn't hide the truth of the fallibility of human beings. And that for me, gives me, you know, and again, there's a zillion other arguments, archaeological arguments, documentary evidence, etc. But just reading it, it has a truth that corresponds to my world experience.
So you come to a self-realization. You realize that what you see as an individual is much further and beyond that which you do see, which you can comprehend.
I guess I wouldn't call it self-realization. I would just say there's such a correspondence between what I see in the world and what's written about in the Bible, and then if you compare that with, you know, any other religious text that you want to look at, all those religious texts seem to create a fantasy world.
Or any other text. Scientific text. Another philosophical.
Well, if I read a chemistry textbook, it seems to have great correlation to what I experience in the world, right? I can go in the lab and do those experiments. And so, to me, that chemistry book seems very reliable. The Bible, for me, in a similar way, it's not a science experiment, but my life experiences correspond to the human interactions that I see in the Bible.
Makes you feel.
What's that?
Makes you, as a person, feel better.
Does it make me feel better? It makes me feel that the Bible is accurate. I certainly don't feel better at all, right? I mean, I wish that Christianity weren't the way it is, right? I wish all people were going to be saved. The Bible is not a comfortable book to read by any stretch of the imagination. It gives me some comfort for a personal sense that I've reached this truth and other people that I know have reached this truth. But Christianity is not a comfortable truth. It doesn't make me feel good in that sense by any stretch of the imagination. But it does seem to correspond to what I've experienced in this world.
So Carl, would your approach in this kind of personal experience be to challenge, kind of as a challenge to read the Bible to that person, or provide stories from the Bible and say, doesn't this line up with your... the person you're discussing with, your view of reality?
It's so, for me,
I only give this answer when someone asks me, why do you believe? I would never use this as, like, if I sit down and had a conversation with someone and wanted to somehow share my faith, that's not where I would go as a lead step. I don't think it makes sense. People have to want to, they have to want to hear that to be open to that idea. So I never use it as a first step in sharing faith. But if someone has gotten to know me and says, Carl, why do you believe in Christianity? Then I go there right away. But it just, like, if I'm meeting a stranger, they don't know me, and there's no reason for them to really give me any credibility when I make that statement. But a person who knows me better and then asks that question is curious to know because they think there is some believability in the things that I've said or the way I've lived my life or something like that. So for me, that I don't use it as a first step. So if someone that maybe that I don't know asks, then I do tend to go to the philosophical, the scientific, the archaeological as my first explanation. But if it's someone that I've gotten to know better over a series of time, and then they say, why do you do this? Then I don't go the scientific, archaeological route at all, and I go to my personal experience and how it corresponds with the Bible.
Okay. I was going to say there's more philosophy for the question we're trying to answer. I don't know if jumping into personal experiences, I would keep pounding on philosophy. You know, there's way more than just cause. There's intelligent design, moral argument, and then maybe move into the Bible. Because I think if you lead in with the Bible, a lot of people are going to be like, this discussion's done.
So I'll jump in very briefly and then open it back up. This is where one of the earlier points I brought up is critical. And Carl made a differentiation between the types of people to whom he is presenting as to how he goes about presenting it. To the random person I don't know, I would use philosophical arguments. To the person who knows me well, I would use these personal experiential arguments right here. The reason that we differentiate between those two is this. The person who doesn't know you is asking the question, is asking an academic question that says, I have an academic concern about whether God exists or doesn't. The person who knows you well who's asking this question knows that your answer to these questions is a religious one. It's a theological one. It fits into a philosophy in that sense. But the idea is they know they're going to get some sort of Christianese out of you when they ask that question. Why are they asking that question? It's probable that what's unstated, when somebody who knows you well asks you that question, it's probable that what they're thinking in their mind is this. You've got something that I want and I don't have. I'm trying to figure out why you have that, what it is that you have. Because deep in their mind, they're also thinking this. He or she is probably deluded or might be deluded. This might be the, I'm just closing my eyes and clicking my heels together and I will be back in Kansas eventually. It'll be okay. Or alternately, maybe they really do know something that's real. So this is why it's important to be able to give a good rational answer to the random skeptic, believer, atheist, agnostic, who ask you these things, and you're probably going to give a philosophical answer. But it's even more critical that you have a really good answer when it comes to why you believe it yourself, because that person is on the cusp of saying, I am ready to think about this for real. Not as an academic problem set in which I might answer and then dismiss regardless of how it comes out. This is meaningful in my life and now I want to know. I'm motivated to learn this one. So I would encourage you, one of the things to take away from this class today would be build yourself an answer to this kind of question from both sides, but prioritize the one that is the person who knows you well asking because they think you've got something they don't have.
So I guess the way I don't go about it either from I wouldn't buy personal experience. I mean, that's not that I wouldn't buy it, but it would be very hard to be convincing for me. And when, like you said, there's a problem when you delve into the deep philosophical and science. You're going to find people are just talking about things. You get lost very quickly.
You represent such a good skeptical position. I want to take advantage of this one being raised and ask and challenge that assertion very quickly. Talking to me, maybe that seems to be the case. Imagine that you've transported back, and this is just post ascension of Christ. You're in Jerusalem. And you've heard these reports running all the way through the area, and you've run into this fellow named Peter. And you say to Peter, why do you think God exists? And Peter says, Well, let me tell you, I walked with this guy for like whatever amount of time. He did all these miracles. I watched them happen in person. In fact, I can introduce you to this guy and this guy who were there when they happened. So there was a very different set.
And that second part is huge. If you'd be like, look, go to John. John's right there. And he told, like, John, what happened? Who is this Jesus guy? And he raised him. Yeah. So I'm not saying that wouldn't happen.
Now, let me make this point, too. For those of you trying to figure out how to fill out this answer, I apologize. I'm cutting you off twice now, but I'll let you get to the rest of it. There were 11 disciples at the time who could have said, I can tell you what I saw from personal experience, these miraculous things that occurred, and I can take you to people that can verify it. That's powerful eyewitness testimony evidence. That exists today. But in the same way that there were only 12 who had access to most of that data, and there were only 3 that had access to probably all of the data, and there were a few thousand, but they're hard to get their hands on because they're all spread out through different parts of the area, who you can take them to and be like, were you there when he healed this blind guy? No, I wasn't there with the blind guy, but I ate the fish that they started off with, you know, 12 baskets. And then you get drilling on them. Did you see that it only started with, one basket, and it ended up feeding 4,000 people? Well, I didn't see the original basket. All right, you don't count. Let me go find a guy that saw the original basket kind of thing. So in a world of several hundreds of thousands of people in that area, there were only a dozen to a few thousand that could answer the questions you're looking for. That actually hasn't changed today. If you want to go find people who have, in fact, had the kinds of personal experiences that, if people are truly open-minded, would be compelling to them, you can look and find those people. And then you can introduce those people to them. Our favorite whipping boy for this particular question at RBC is Jamie Winship. Right, you can take people to Jamie Winship, and he can tell you about, here I was on the roof of my house in Baghdad, and the soldier appeared, and he spoke to him a couple times, and the guy didn't answer anything back to him, and he turned back, the guy had disappeared. And he felt that, and you know, this isn't a terribly convincing one, but this was an angel that was protecting them at the time that, you know, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, now that happens on occasion, usually because of a different reason. You can hear a lot of these Jamie Winship stories, and when you take somebody to Jamie Winship, you know what they're not expecting to hear from Jamie Winship? Please list out for me whether or not there's a cyclical model of the universe that you find sufficiently compelling that it can answer the question of whether a thermodynamic system can recollapse in a way that restores its entropy, initial entropy condition. Jamie ain't going to tell you that. Well, people go to Jamie ready to hear stories of something miraculous happen, and if it's convincing, they will be partially convinced or maybe completely convinced. And Jamie usually won't sit there and tell them, well, let me tell you the 5 different miracles and you can evaluate it. He might tell them one story, and then you know what his next step is? What do you think his next step is, if you haven't heard this yourself? Hey, you willing to sit down and pray with me and see what God says to you? And he sits down and he does something he calls listening prayer with them. Now, some people, that's compelling too, and some people, doesn't work for them at all. But just something to keep in mind.
That's what he does.
That's what he does. And all I'm saying to you is that resource exists if you're willing to go look for it. And you've already got kind of a guy or a set of guys and gals here in the church that can give you some of those stories and to whom you can take other people. And don't be afraid. You should never, ever be afraid when answering somebody's question to say, I can give you my answer, but my answer depends on something Carl had to say and something Steve had to say. If you're actually interested, let's go have lunch with Steve and Carl. I'll buy lunch. Free lunch, plus an answer to your question, plus you get to meet Steve. You know what a great thing.
So I apologize. I have a tendency to ramble without actually making my point. So here's my point.
I can identify with that very, very closely.
This is why I believe that there is a God. If there is no God, it does not matter what I think. If there is a God, but he is impersonal, meaning he has absolutely nothing, he doesn't have any kind of relation to me other than maybe creating the universe, then it still does not matter. But if there is a God out there and he wants to somehow connect with me, then it absolutely matters what I think of him.
Okay.
So when I look at the world around me, I don't even look at the world around me. I just know myself that if there is this deity, this divine force out there, well, and I know that I should behave in a certain kind of way, I know that I don't live up to my own standards of behavior, let alone a standard of something that has programmed me to behave in a certain way. And so I could deduce that if there is this divine force and he has essentially wired me to behave in a certain way, then he's got to be pretty pissed off. I put myself at odds, for lack of a better term.
I've heard that word twice this morning.
So let's look at all the systems of thought out there and see which of these address this best. When I look at it, Christianity is the only one that says that bad people go to heaven. Every other religion says, or every other system of thought says, do X amount of good things or things, and then maybe you can be made right with this divine force. But if this divine force really does care about how I behave, Christianity seems to be the only model which that would allow a good force to put myself in right standing.
It's spiritual capitalism. It's the only one that takes into account the true nature of mankind.
When I look at all the other things, it's not to say that there aren't good things about Buddhism or about Hinduism or atheism and agnosticism. It's just that when it comes to actually how looking at here a little bit.
Because you're watching me writing what you're saying.
Like, yeah. All the things that I know I have not done. Right? Like all the bad things I've done. It's the only one that makes sense to put me in a right standing with that divine force. Now, of course, where the theist and the agnostic is going to hit on a whole lot of different points in here. They're going to say, oh, well, you know, what's your thing that you feel that the thing that compels you to act in certain ways, really just a byproduct of the chemical processes in your brain and evolutionary forces, social forces. That may be true, but no one actually practically believes that.
Right.
What I mean by that is that if morality, for what it's called what it is just the byproduct of social and evolutionary forces, then I can dislike something, but I can never actually say it's wrong. So I can't, you know, I hate to use this example, it's always used, but like, I love this song. I may dislike what Stalin's done, but if it's just a matter of his brain chemistry differing from mine, there's nothing objectively wrong about it. I may dislike it. And you might be willing to.
So it's what you eat is going to make you a Stalin.
But I'm saying that's.
Well, this isn't very interesting. It seems to me variation on a wager on Pascal's
it's
wager, but this
Pascal's
isn't Pascal's wager because Pascal's wager is all about happiness. He says my end goal is happiness, and this system or that system, either God exists or He doesn't exist. In the God exists system, what's going to make me ultimately happy is acting like a Christian does, because God will reward that in the next life. If it turns out that we're wrong and God does, and there is no God, well, Christians actually seem to be the most happy people out there. So it all worked out for me anyway, if happiness was my goal. So he makes a happiness as the goal argument. Randy has said something a step past what Pascal says, because Randy's already saying, I believe I have moral intuitions that I have to trust at some level because I believe in right and wrong as strongly as I do anything. So if I believe that there's this right and wrong, my moral intuitions also further into it. And I skip some steps here, but in the interest of time, probably. But ultimately says, of the religions, I sense intuitively that there is some sort of moral law. I'm going to make it simple. If there's a moral law, I infer a moral lawgiver from that one. Maybe I can deduce a moral lawgiver from that one. There is a deductive argument for morality. We've gone over it in here. So let's say that I'm deductively find that there's a moral ground for these moral truths, an absolute ground for these moral truths, and this is God. Well, now we got another problem set, which is, all right, so there's a God, but the Hindus say there's a God, the Buddhists say there's something like God, the Muslims say there's a God and this is who he is, the Jews say there's a God and this is who he is, the Christians say it's the Jews' God, but here's some further stuff about him that not all Jews would sign up to say the least. So how do I know which one of these? And Randy is turning around and saying, okay, what are the requirements of each of those religions? Each of them require you to do a certain number of things in order to please this God. Of all of those, only Christianity actually provides you a solution that's workable. So since you're going to fail at all the other ones, you might as well bet on the only one you can get done. Now, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but that's basically the argument he's making. He's making a religious wager argument that says, there's only one bet out there that I can reasonably win, so I'm going to put all my money on that bet. That is a an interesting way of doing it that I have thought about, but I haven't had it articulated like you have articulated it yet. So that's an interesting point. Okay, in the interest of time, and because we've gotten so much good stuff done on this question, would you guys like to run back through this one and... with your permission, and if you object to this, stop me. But if not, I'll go back through here and we'll make some quick points on some of these things that were made philosophically. And then I'll give you a little bit of, this time, a homework assignment that I really, really would like y'all to do before next time. So I won't give you my answer to how I answer this question, but I'll give you the homework assignment and see what it is. So let's go through here and see if this was a good answer so far. Why are you so sure God exists? So let's say we're asking the skeptic. Somebody goes to, basically, we need an explanation of the world that we see. There's a Kalam cosmological argument. In reality, the question he asked was Leibniz's cosmological argument. So Leibniz's cosmological argument addresses the question that Steve was bringing up. A natural other way to do it that's a little bit more scientifically grounded for those of us who are living in this century, in this millennium, is going to the Kalam cosmological argument that gives you these three things. Now, some people have said, well, you've got to check. Remember, you can only... interestingly, someone talked about Krauss challenging the cause of the universe. The universe has a cause. This right here is challenging the solution, the conclusion. You can't challenge the conclusion. You have to challenge one of the two premises. So that's the first thing to note is don't get to challenge the conclusion. It's a deductive argument. You got to challenge the premises. So in reality, Krauss is talking about, Krauss is interesting enough that he challenges that anything that begins to exist has a cause. That we'll leave that one off because that position is I think, very easy to show that that's not supportable. But that the universe began to exist. What if the universe goes all the way back into the past and there is no, that this, maybe it can go infinitely into the past and that's not a problem, and maybe it's a series of, like the Carol Chin model, where you've got these universes that recompact themselves and they bounce back and forth. And Chin, or Carol, drew a direction of entropy. It's not actually E, but I'm just abbreviating it that way for here. That entropy goes this way in both directions. Well, somebody might point out that this actually represents a beginning, and what you're really talking about is time going in both directions. So this is two separate universes that have time leaving this singularity right here at this point. So somebody else talks about about Hawking having a solution to this problem. So will a cyclical model work? I just erased all that. Not good. Isn't that a simpler explanation? And Carl points out, well, there is no working model of a thermodynamically reversible one. Well, Hawking actually doesn't have a thermodynamically reversible model. He has one, the Hawking model that he talks about when he's talking about entropy changes don't have to do with the cyclical model of the universe. That one has to do in some ways with the restoration of the initial conditions. But the reason that most people think cyclical models don't work is when you recollapse universes, every model that we've ever come up with, every one that we can possibly make, ends up because it's not a completely homogeneous universe, because everything isn't evenly spread out. If everything's very evenly, perfectly spread out, you can put it, and quantum fluctuations don't occur, you can bring everything back down to a single, very tightly compact problem. If it turns out, though, that there's little dots of density in there, like galaxies or stars, when you do that, they collapse faster than the rest of the universe does. Or maybe their gravitational wells deepen more rapidly. And what happens is all kinds of singularities develop. And then the universe starts rotating when it gets really small, and it rotates so fast that it won't collapse. And it ends up spinning itself back out, and it bubbles and warps, and it won't actually collapse back into a singularity. So the bottom line is nobody, this idea doesn't scientifically work. So that's something that you can go point out as well, is there are no models of the universe that you can scientifically say, even speculative ones, that would work in that condition. So this was an interesting analytical point that we'll skip for now, just because it gets into the epistemology that underlies all this stuff, but I think that there's a lot of fruitful discussion that can be done there. We pointed out that we've kind of gone to philosophy. We talked about personal experiences a little bit, and I think I gave my recommendation on personal experiences. One thing I would say for yourselves is this. If you have not experienced the miraculous in your life, in such a way that it's compelling to you, that when you tell the story, so to speak, when you go home that day and you say, you know, I said this was a reason that I can conclude that God exists. Do I really think that? If the answer at the end of the day is no, I think it's reason to suspect God might be out there, but I don't think it's compelling evidence that God's out there. Compelling evidence that God's out there, I watched my rabbi get crucified, and now he's standing there again, and then he disappears, and then he's back again. That kind of thing, that I would list that under compelling. If you don't have that experience, that doesn't mean you ought to worry about it. That doesn't mean that you're like, well, I got to go out and have one of these miraculous experiences, or I'm in deep trouble. Does Jesus believe that we all need to have that in order to be happy? Not to be happy, to be convinced that this is right and thus be happy. The answer there is no. Because what does he say to his apostles about seeing the miracles?
You've touched my wounds and you believe, but blessed are those that
who have not seen these things and still believe. Yes, exactly right. So he knows that we will be in this condition. Now, lest you turn around and say, well, that doesn't leave us with anything satisfying. This is why when we get to that person to whom you're answering, and that person, by the way, let's say it's just yourself. Never learned how to silence that thing effectively. I always want to ask this question. And I thought about Randy earlier in exactly this vein, because Randy is kind of represents our ultimate skeptic in solid ground for now. Now, Randy has given you, by the way, what is convincing to him. So although he takes the skeptical position, he's at least outlined something that embraces a lot of uncertainty, but is still sufficiently compelling to him that he believes it or something like it. So that's important to note. And that what Randy has done right here is what you have to get at. Ask the person, and in this case it's yourself, what is my standard? And when I say standard, I mean a belief. So if you've listened to Randy or guys like Randy before, you might conclude, well, this guy can't even reasonably think that he exists, or that the world isn't, he's not a brain in a vat, or that the world, you know, isn't even here. It's all an illusion. Okay. Ask Randy what he believes on a daily basis. And you can do that by watching him have breakfast. Right, so what does he eat for breakfast? He eats eggs and toast, maybe. He doesn't eat nuts and bolts. He doesn't eat paper. He doesn't just drink water. Why? Well, because Randy actually believes something about metabolism. Randy actually believes something about his own digestion and health. Okay, so then you ask him, well, do you know for a fact that eating paper isn't good for you? And Randy will give you a properly skeptical response back, but at the end of the day, you can tell what he believes by what he does. So whatever Randy's standard is for himself, don't try is one that you yourself have. So you do certain things because you believe they're right. You treat your kids in a certain way. You treat your parents in a certain way. You go to your job because you believe certain things. You do certain things morally speaking. Don't you treat people morally as though you act like moral things really exist? These are not to be overlooked. And what I would point out to the skeptic and the person asking the question is always this: what is my standard? How high is it? And what do you use to prove it? And you always, always, always argue to a person's standard of proof. Because if you just turn around and start answering your own standard, you can always gun deck that one. I mean, look, maybe Carl sometime will ask to do a class on this one about how much a good prosecutor or defense person can take apart and impeach a witness who, by the way, was there, saw it all happen, and the attorney and the lawyer knows that. But they can still make them look highly suspect and questionable, and maybe even get the witness confused on the stand about something that they know and a memory that they've had, because they happen to know how human psychology works and all that kind of stuff. So what is my standard? And then answer the question, answer to that standard. So what I would tell you is this. When you're going to answer a question, and this is my last word for today, other than the kind of homework assignment. If you start answering a question anywhere but trying to ascertain and articulate what either your standard is or the other person's standard is, you are engaging in a wild goose chase. Now, it might be compelling to them eventually, because at the end of the day, they'll walk away from it and say, still be we say convicted by it. They'll still think like, I don't know, I heard a lot of good information there. I thought it was going to be challengeable. So it's not that that's useless, but the most effective way to answer a question is to find out what question you're really trying to answer and what standard you're really trying to meet, and then don't try to hold it too high a standard. If you listen to Randy normally, you might conclude that you'll never answer anything to Randy's standard. But the bottom line is Randy answers stuff to Randy's standard, and here he gave you an example of what actually was compelling to him. So now you know where you really need to shoot. And even though he might gun deck all your answers past that, if you've actually hit this standard right here that is Randy's standard, you will have been compelling and convincing to Randy. He may not tell you on the grounds. He may not admit it to himself for a while, but you've gotten, quote-unquote, inside his head. I'm not in here to say, or your own head, if it happens to be the way that you're answering it. So this is, by the way, y'all did, I think, a really good job. You made me really feel good about Solid Ground that we're getting good stuff done here, because a lot of the key points about how to answer this question were stuff that you brought up. So thank you for having done such a good job. It makes me feel pretty good about it. All right, the homework assignment for next time is this. And the reason I want you to do, and you only have to do one of them. The other one is extra credit. The one of them is you are at the point of death. Okay, you are on your deathbed, and there is nobody else around. The nurse is coming in to check once in a while, but you know that, and the doc has told you, been like, well, you got 24 hours, you know, so make your peace. Your family's not there. They've already visited. It is 4 in the morning, and nobody's there visiting you. And you're having the thought, okay, I've believed a lot of stuff in my own life. I've believed a lot of stuff about God. I've told people a lot of stuff about God. Now you're asking the question, I'm about to step to the other side. Why am I convinced that this that I have said I believe is true? So why do you think that God exists, and why do you think he is who you think he is, and that you have done whatever it is, like Rand, maybe it's what Randy's talking about, that you have satisfied that God so that when you're going to meet him or her or it face to face, that you have done properly or are thinking properly or have made the right commitment or whatever it is you think you have to do. So be ready to answer that question, because that's the real question. All the rest of this can be bloviating, can be academic grandstanding, can be self-deception. That's where the question gets real. The extra credit question is, if you are talking to somebody, I'm going to put them 1 foot in both camps. They both have real academic concerns, and then but they also know you, and they know that you are a Christian, and they know you to be a quote-unquote good person, furthermore. They see something real about your life that says to them, this guy or gal's got something that I want, and they ask you, why do you think God exists, and why do you think that I ought to think that? How do you give them a short answer? And I'm not very good at giving short answers, but if you got to give them an elevator answer to it, and it's going to be a few minutes long, maybe 10 to 15 minutes long if you want to, but shorter if you want to, what does that answer look like? And so those are the two questions, all right? You on your deathbed, why do you believe what you believe? The person who's asking, who knows you a little bit, what answer do you give them? Not on a debate stage, not talking to somebody else. Somebody is sitting across the coffee table from you, and you've got coffee table time to talk to them. How do you do it in the way that is as compelling as you possibly can? The reason I'm asking y'all to do that one is this. We're about to embark on 2 years' worth of study into the core of these kinds of things that represent the belief systems that we all claim to believe, and the challenges to them, and the answers to those challenges, and that kind of stuff. But ultimately, if you at the core don't know the answer, then whoever marketing or advertising or whatever you want to call it, when they mention in the service, hey, here's a Solid Ground class, this is what's going on. When those people come in here, if they're only listening to me, that's not enough. They need to hear it from you as well. And then I would also talk about that in your school, in your work, in your social places, in your shepherd groups. That's something else we talked about. If you have shepherd groups, and if you don't, I would encourage you to get involved in it as well. A lot of times, I don't know if you sat in these shepherd groups before, but people will ask questions that deserve good answers, and nobody gives a good answer. They have excellent, nobody gives a good answer sometimes. I've sat in these sometimes because I'm thinking, you can't answer that question reasonably in 3 minutes or 5 minutes. False. You can. You can, and you can give people something to follow up on. So you guys might be the expertise that does that as well. And if not, then you are at least, by being here, sovereignly appointed to be somebody, and having the answers and interest that you have, sovereignly appointed in the future probably to answer this question for somebody. So get your question answer prepared. and be ready to do that. All right. Any final last-minute stuff before we break for next time? Are you willing to do the homework assignment? Anybody generally? Okay. All right. Do it. Come back with just at least the hand notes of it or whatever, and let's hear a few of them next time and see how they go. Okay, last bit, and then we dismiss. Now we're over time, but as you know, next service doesn't start now until 10:45, so we're stealing time. We are about to pour into cement the program for the next 2 years and the format for the next 2 years. Just by brief reminder, the format was a little bit of lecture / discussion, and three times in that 45 minutes initially, we will break for questions and back and forth. And at the end of that 45 minutes, we go into open discussion time. So that's the general format that we're going to try to follow. If you don't like that, now's the time for feedback. Facebook, email, whatever you want. Tell us face-to-face. Tell us if you want to change it, you want to tweak it. If this system, If this system doesn't work, let us know. Tell us anything that you would rather do.
Is there a way to capture that?
Yes, I'll capture this, and this will be hopefully posted as part of the video, like a link to this on the video that we put up. But then, of course, this should also, we hope this will be visible on the YouTube video or whatever that goes up as well. So format, if you got anything, if topic you want to tweak it, that's still possible. I mean, ultimately what we want to talk about is Christian doctrine, not dry theological doctrine, but doctrine insofar as we believe things. What stuff are we supposed to believe as Christians, or what, when we claim to be Christians, what are we at least saying that we believe, and have we thought our way through it, and can we explain it to other people? And then any other feedback points that you want, you got about 3 weeks to do it, and then it's going to get poured in cement. Last points, rejoinders, questions, anything else? Sir?
Pre-reads. Are you going to give suggestions for pre-reads?
Yes, we will also, there'll be a lot. We're working with Travis, who does the webpage. Are there going to be any pre-read material? What we're hoping to do is generate a running and steadily increasing library of data. Some of these libraries will be the classes themselves, but for those who sat through them, you don't want to go listening back to a whole class you just sat through in order to find one or two key points or references. Anytime we make a reference to a work or a video or a place, we're hoping to mark that and link it so that you can go back and be like, we talked about arguments for God. He mentioned something in that class I thought was important. What was the reference that he mentioned? So you should see kind of a bibliography and a library that follows that. And if we're particularly clever, we'll figure out a way to hot link so that you can just click on that link and it leads you right off to either that other YouTube video or whatever else. So yes, we're intending to build a library, but for those of you that are clever about those things and you know how to, a good way to tell us to do that, don't let me try to figure it out, because you'll end up with something like this. What else? Anything else? You guys are absolutely terrific. Thank you for being a part of Solid Ground. This is a ministry that I think is necessary at this church. It's already generating talk amongst the elders about whether their own doctrinal views are sufficient, whether they have articulated for the church truth in a way that is understandable for the church, and whether they've got it right themselves. So you'll hear this again in October, but remember what the Great Commission was. Go you therefore and make disciples of all nations. What's the next word? Teaching them to observe all that I've commanded you. Christ didn't actually tell people to go out and quote unquote spread the gospel, where the gospel was just Jesus died for your sins, all you gotta do is accept him. That is not what was said. What he said was go out and make disciples and teach them all that I have commanded you. Not teach them that I am the way, the truth, and the life. That's part of it. But teach them all that I have commanded you. The doctrine of Christianity, doctrines of Christianity, are, at least at their core, these are all the things that Christ taught. And the Great Commission is to teach these things. If you don't know them, you cannot do the Great Commission. So you'll see why this is important, and you'll see why I'm very excited to have y'all as, hopefully, as a core of the class as we go into the next year and two and whatever else. Thanks a ton. Hit us on Facebook, on email.